New York.
Good morning. Elon Musk is facing criticism for making Twitter a less safe space for people on the platform. Former members of the company's Trust and Safety Council say he's lost sight of its commitment to users. Some resigned last week.
Anti-Semitic posts went up by 61%. Against gay men, the corresponding number is 58%. I find that highly unacceptable.
I'm Carrie Nolan. It's Morning Edition from NPR and WNYC. The Federal Reserve is expected to hike interest rates again. Residents of mobile home parks lose their places to live as investors buy up parkland for redevelopment. And the MTA will start rolling out new cars. They'll have some new features, but a less conversational seating configuration. It's Monday, December 12th. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Libyan man suspected of making the bomb that took down an American passenger plane over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988 is now in U.S. custody. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more on an arrest that was 34 years in the making.
The Justice Department says Abu Aguila Mohammed Masoud Kira al-Marimi made the bomb that detonated on Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. 270 people were killed, including 190 Americans. Two Libyan operatives were initially charged and tried in a special court. One was convicted, the other acquitted. Years later, federal investigators had a breakthrough after Masoud allegedly confessed to the Lockerbie bombing in an interview with Libyan authorities. That led the Justice Department to charge Masoud in 2020. On Sunday, the Libyans handed Masoud over to an FBI team, which flew him back to the U.S. to face trial in federal court in Washington, D.C. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Opening statements get underway today in the second trial of Oath Keepers members accused of the rarely used charge of seditious conspiracy. They're charged with plotting to use force to block the transfer of power to President Biden. Four members of the group are on trial, charged with helping Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes to carry out the plot. He and another member were convicted about 2 weeks ago of the same charge. Twitter is relaunching a program to sell verified check marks on its platform. NPR's Bobby Allen says the first attempt by the social media platform's new owner, Elon Musk, led to a flood of impersonators and scammers.
This time, Twitter says a few things will be different. First, before someone will receive a check mark, there will actually be a verification process, unlike last time. And there are new colors. Gray checks for governments, gold checks for companies, and blue for individuals. But with less than half of its staff remaining, experts are concerned the company will not have the resources to properly authenticate accounts. Another worry is that trolls, bullies, and spreaders of misinformation will now have a larger megaphone in exchange for being paid subscribers. Twitter, which does not have a communications department, did not respond to a request for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Los Angeles has a new mayor. Former U.S. Congresswoman, Democrat Karen Bass, has taken the oath of office. It was administered yesterday by Vice President Kamala Harris. In her speech, Bass says there are many Los Angeles priorities that all deserve focused, immediate attention.
A pandemic, a rapidly changing economy, a rapidly changing climate, the cost of living, and in Los Angeles, 40,000 people sleeping on the street every day.
Bass says that today she plans to declare a state of emergency to deal with homelessness in Los Angeles. A powerful winter storm is striking the central U.S. The National Weather Service has posted blizzard warnings from northern Colorado to parts of Montana. You're listening to NPR News.
This is WNYC in New York at 8:04. Good morning. I'm Carrie Nolan. Another person has died in New York City custody. 39-year-old Edgardo Mejia died at Rikers Island Jail Complex yesterday. He'd been in custody for about 2 months. He was the 19th person this year to die while in city custody or shortly after release. The New York City Department of Correction says his cause of death is under investigation. More people have died in city custody in 2022 than any other year since 2013, when the jail housed twice as many inmates. Last month, a judge declined to strip New York City of its authority over Rikers, despite growing calls for the appointment of a federal receiver. New York City's early COVID-19 relief funds for small businesses were distributed unequally across the city. That's according to a new audit by city controller Brad Lander.
It's kind of depressing. I don't think it was in any way the intention of the Department of Small Business Services, but Manhattan small businesses were significantly overserved, and Bronx small businesses in particular were really significantly underserved.
Lander did not collect applicants' race data, but said the geographic inequities could also reflect racial disparities.
There's a real good reason to believe that, you know, in part what this reflects is a higher percentage of white small business owners versus a higher percentage of Latino and Black and small business owners of color.
The city controller examined two early pandemic loan and grant programs. He found that just 9 of the 519 Bronx applicants received loans. New Jersey will receive a portion of a $435 million multi-state settlement with e-cigarette maker Juul. Last week, Attorney General Matthew Platkin announced that New Jersey will receive nearly $34 million from the settlement by 2027. If the agreement is approved by the court, the first installment would be due by the end of this year. The Attorney General says Juul has targeted young people,
specifically tailoring advertising practices as well as the products themselves to encourage youth to use them in a way that was dangerous.
The settlement comes after a 2-year investigation by more than 30 states, including New Jersey, that focused on Juul's targeted marketing. Mostly sunny skies today. Once those clouds get out of the way, we'll see highs in the upper 30s. It'll be clear tonight with lows in the mid-20s, and then a couple of sunny days ahead of us. Both Tuesday and Wednesday sunny with highs around 40 degrees. Right now, 32 and cloudy in New York City.
Support for NPR comes from DuckDuckGo, a company committed to making privacy online simple. DuckDuckGo's app includes a private search engine, web browser, and email protection with one download. More at DuckDuckGo.com.
On the next Brian Lehrer Show, when should New York City landlords be allowed to ask a prospective tenant if they've been convicted of a crime? A bill in city council would strike that question in most situations. We'll discuss the pros and cons. Also, New York Magazine's 39 Reasons to Love New York and your calls with yours. The Brian Lehrer Show, weekdays at 10 a.m. on WNYC.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm A. Martinez. For the first time in its 241-year history, Los Angeles' mayor is a Black woman. Karen Bass was sworn in on Sunday by Vice President Kamala Harris.
Her first order of business, the city's homelessness crisis.
I will start my first day as mayor at the city's emergency operations centers, where my first act as mayor will be to declare a state of emergency on homelessness.
She'll also deal with a scandal-ridden city council as she tries to push her agenda through.
Benjamin Oreskes is a Metro reporter with the LA Times. Benjamin, so Mayor Bass wants to start with a state of emergency on homelessness. Who's on board and what will that do?
Thanks for having me. The question of who's on board, she has, it's sort of answered by who was at her inauguration. Almost every member of the city council, save one, and we're going to talk about him in a minute, was there and was excited to be there and excited to be working with her on this issue. A state of emergency has a sort of political and practical dimension. The practical one is that it gives her a lot more power, flexibility, and freedom to deploy resources, staff, and money in various different directions to address this crisis that voters, you know, indicated in any number of ways was the most important in the city. The political part of this is that it, again, tells people, this is the most important thing on my plate, and it's all I'm going to be thinking about. So conveying an urgency to Angelenos who are very angry about the state of their streets.
And Benjamin, catch us up on the politics part of Los Angeles, because there's a lot of dysfunction happening around the city council. And the last few days have been especially terrible.
They are. The one member of the city council who didn't show up to her inauguration was Kevin De Leon. Kevin was caught on a tape that was recorded last year, And he's on it with two members of the city council and a labor leader. And they're making crude, racist remarks. It's in the context of redistricting. They're talking about that process. But he says, and they all say, some not so nice things about their colleagues, some racist comments about one of their colleagues' sons. And two of the members sort of hid. One resigned. One just sort of stayed out of the way. He's now termed out. But Kevin has dug his heels in. He hasn't, though, showed up for city council meetings. He did, though, for the first time in months on Friday. What also then occurred is that he went to a holiday party, and protesters who have been dogging him for much longer since this tape came out got in his face, and he was fed up and sort of attacked one of these protesters. It was a brawl of sorts. All of this takes place under the backdrop of a city where we have a member of the city council who was indicted. We have multiple former members who were indicted, and just a broader sense from Angelenos that the bodies of government in the city are not working for them. It's what propelled the candidacy of Karen Bass's opponent, Rick Caruso. And it's also what a lot of the healing that Karen Bass has talked about needing to do.
And so how is the new mayor talking about how she'll try to heal some of those divides?
Well, she is someone whose biography is about bringing people together. This is a community activist, starts after the civil unrest in 1992, starts a nonprofit called Community Coalition. She then joins the state assembly and then on to Congress. You know, she has been all about meeting with people, listening to their problems, and trying again to bring people together. And I think you saw during her inauguration a real sense, a real relief even from other elected officials about her ascendance and a desire to work with her to get things done.
That's Benjamin Oreskes from the LA Times. Benjamin, thanks.
Thank you.
Mobile homes have long been an affordable housing option, but big investment firms have been buying up the land they sit on, causing homeowners to worry about whether they'll be able to stay. From member station WBUR in Boston, Simone Rios reports on how corporate ownership is upending the lives of people in one park.
Outside John Piazza's trailer, the 84-year-old former harbor captain and amateur historian is sorting through his life's belongings.
You want drills? I got a bunch for you to take home. Look at them. Keep them. There's three or four. Keep them.
His son, John Jr., is helping him pack and trying to persuade him to toss more stuff. They argue over a pile of boxes Piazza hopes a cousin will take.
Listen, look at it. Joe's auntie,
Joe's auntie's been there three different times.
No.
If he doesn't take them, he doesn't want them.
How do you know?
Well, I don't know. If he wanted, he would have.
He's in love with them. He grabbed the two bikes.
Yeah.
Piazza has lived more than two decades at Lee's Trailer Park in Revere, a small working-class city just north of Boston. Living in a mobile home was a good choice for him when rent control ended in Boston in the 90s.
I said, let me look at it, and I fell in love with it. I said, wow, this is bigger than my apartment. And I bought it. $20,000.
Mobile home parks are home to 22 million people across the country. But they've become a target for corporate investors, accounting for roughly a quarter of park sales, according to the firm Real Capital Analytics. Residents worry this means increased rents and the possibility of displacement, because even those who own their mobile homes don't usually own the land they sit on. Piazza was planning to spend the rest of his days at Lee's Trailer Park, but a year and a half ago, it was sold to an entity managed by a Boston investment firm, Helg Capital. They soon started evicting people to make way for a new housing development. Piazza recalls standing outside with his neighbors as one of them watched his house being destroyed.
The person that runs the machine put the top jaw on top and the bottom jaw above the metal frame and squish, and that whole wall came off.
The park's new owners wouldn't agree to an interview, but in a statement, they said they have treated every resident fairly. They've also been compensating residents for the value of homes that can't easily be moved. The park's former owner, William Setapan, says he feels for some of the people whose trailers were crushed, but...
Well, they're paying the people, though. And he agrees to take it. They ain't doing nothing wrong. They ain't forcing no one to take it.
Setapan also says the new housing development planned would be a big improvement over the park, which he says has long been dogged by drugs and crime.
The city should be glad that they get rid of the park, because it was nothing but a problem, even though I was the owner.
Mobile park advocates say parks like Lee's get into bad shape because park owners let it happen, and cities don't do enough to stop it.
This looks like there was certainly a home here and maybe over here where the dumpster is. Dumpster's not covered. Minor things, but still violations. Drainage is a problem.
So we have wetlands issues here, too.
You see here, it looks like a river or a brook.
Boston University public health instructor Ethan Maskoop sits on the State Manufactured Homes Commission. He surveyed Lee's trailer park and spotted one health violation after another, even though people still live there.
It looks like a remains of a war. There's stuff strewn about. There's people's some belongings. It's very, very sad.
Maskoop says he wants to know where the city is with so many apparent health violations. The Revere mayor's office did not respond to multiple requests for interviews, but in the meantime, the park's population is slowly dwindling. Roughly 100 people have already left Lee's, and just 17 mobile homes remain. Those are gradually being removed as well. Back at John Piazza's mobile home, surrounded by decades worth of belongings, his son John Jr. says it's sad to see his dad forced to leave this way.
I mean, his independence is gone. He can walk out here, get in his car, go shopping and stuff like that. Now,
exactly.
You know, he's not going to be able to do that in the city.
That's because Piazza is headed to an assisted living home in Boston, where he won't have his car any longer. He doesn't want to leave, but he counts his blessings. He says some of the people who lived at Lee's trailer park have no place to go. For NPR News, I'm Simone Rios in Boston.
NASA's Orion spacecraft is back on Earth after a 25-day mission around the moon. It's a critical test for the agency's newest Artemis lunar program, which plans to send astronauts on a similar trip. From member station WMFE, Brendan Byrne reports.
When the Orion capsule hit Earth's atmosphere, it was traveling around 25,000 miles per hour. By the time it splashed down in the Pacific Ocean, under a canopy of parachutes, the gumdrop-shaped capsule slowed to just 20 miles per hour.
From Tranquility Base to Taurus Littro to the tranquil waters of the Pacific, the latest chapter of NASA's journey to the moon comes to a close.
It was the end of Orion's journey that took it nearly 270,000 miles from Earth. The $4 billion mission, dubbed Artemis 1, comes after years of development and delays for NASA's next chapter in human lunar exploration. This mission carried no crew, but tested important systems of the spacecraft. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson.
This has been an extraordinarily successful mission.
One of the most critical pieces of hardware on Orion is its heat shield. NASA tested a brand new one and tried a different kind of reentry called a skip. Orion dipped down into the atmosphere, then steered its way out, like swimming through the boundary of Earth and space, to pinpoint its landing spot. Orion's trip pushed the spacecraft to its limit, says NASA's Howard Hugh.
We've been able to accomplish over 122 of our flight test objectives that we had planned, and we added a bonus of 20 real-time flight test objectives as well.
What NASA learns from this mission will help the next one, a similar flight but with astronauts, and a third trip to land humans on the moon. But space policy analyst Laura Forsick says there's much still to be done. NASA needs new spacesuits and a lunar lander.
Overall, this is a really good first step, but it's only the first step. It's the very beginning.
Exactly 50 years before Orion's splashdown, Apollo 17's Gene Cernan spoke humanity's last words on the moon, quote, "We leave as we came, and God willing, we shall return with peace and hope for all mankind." With Artemis 1, NASA is a step closer to fulfilling that promise. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WNYC. Today is the feast day honoring the patron saint of Mexico. In Mexico City, millions of people are making the pilgrimage to the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe to light candles and pray. And we'll have more on that story coming up ahead this hour. And then on the BBC News Hour at 9, a report on the violent treatment of Russian soldiers who refuse to fight in Ukraine. And the new president of Peru promises early elections after fierce clashes between security forces and supporters of the ousted previous president. That's coming up on the BBC NewsHour at 9 o'clock on 93.9 FM.
WNYC is supported by National Geographic Documentary Films, presenting The Territory, an immersive look at an indigenous community's fight against deforestation by illegal settlers in the Brazilian Amazon. Awards eligible, now streaming only on Disney+.
The holiday season is a time to reflect on how you nourish the relationships that sustain you, how you help them survive and grow despite obstacles. When you nourish those connections, they feed you right back. Just like how your support of WNYC ensures we can be there for you when you need us. So please make a year-end contribution. We can't do any of this without your help. Call 888-376-WNYC or go to WNYC.org now. And thank you.
It's 32 degrees under cloudy skies in New York City, but as you may know, many of us at New York Public Radio are still working remotely, and from my window, skies appear to be brightening over Staten Island. It'll be mostly sunny today, with highs in the upper 30s. Tonight, clear skies with lows in the mid-20s, and sunny again tomorrow and Wednesday. Tomorrow's high in the lower 40s, Wednesday's high around 40 degrees.
Support for NPR comes from member stations and from BritBox, for lovers of British TV, offering a varied selection of British mysteries, dramas, comedies, and other programming. Gift subscriptions available at BritBox.com/gifting. Fisher Investments. Fisher Investments' team of specialists offer guidance on investing, retirement income, and Social Security. FisherInvestments.com. Investments in securities involve the risk of loss. And UMA, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Hugh Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Rob Schmitz in Washington, D.C. The prisoner swap between Russian arms dealer Victor Boot for American basketball player Brittany Griner came as a disappointment to many on the African continent. The so-called Merchant of Death helped fuel several bloody conflicts by selling arms and munitions to oppressive regimes and rebel forces there. Joining me now is Masa Washington, a Liberian journalist who covered the Liberian Civil War in the 1990s. She was threatened for criticizing the government and eventually sought asylum in the United States. Masa, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Masa, Victor Boot sold weapons to regimes throughout the world and throughout Africa. What was his role in your home country of Liberia during its civil wars in the 90s and early 2000s?
Well, in Liberia, during the early years of our civil war, he was known for being the major arms dealer to the NPFL, rebels of Mr. Charles Taylor, who is now incarcerated in the British prison.
And of course, Charles Taylor was the Liberian warlord who then became...
Turned president.
Exactly, and was became a notorious war criminal.
So Mr. Boot was his business partner and also arms supplier and arms dealer that fueled the Liberian Civil War in Liberia. And as a result of that war, Liberia has an estimated 250,000 to 300,000 people that died in the Liberian Civil War, and more than 20,000 child soldiers were forcibly conscripted and turned into killing machines. Most of them were killed, and the vast majority of them are now what street children, they're men and women now, but what we call Zocos. So they are now the outcasts of society. So Mr. Victor Boot's role in the Civil War in Liberia has left devastating impact for the people of Liberia, including myself. So we are worried and we are concerned now that he's been released. And our concern is that Liberia is a porous country in terms of governance. There's been no accountability for war crimes that took place in Liberia. And most of the warlords and rebel generals who fought the war are in Liberia. They are in position of trust. They've rebranded themselves. They are in position of trust. Some of them are in the legislature and the Senate. Some of them are in mainstream government. Some of them are now businessmen. They are millionaires. So we are worried because former colleagues and partners of Mr. Victor Bout are in Liberia. They're running Liberia. You know, they have political power. They have the economic strength. So we are worried what this portends for Liberia. Is he going to come back to Liberia? Is Mr. Victor Bout going to rekindle his relationships with his former or war partners who are now the people who are running Liberia? This is very worrisome for us. We worry what it portends for the security, safety, and stability of Liberia that is still struggling with the after effect of the civil war.
Masa, was Bout's role in these conflicts that you're talking about in the past well known at the time that they were happening?
No, at the time, the people of Liberia really didn't know. Don't forget, the war was going on. The war was vicious. We had, by the first year of the war, we had more than 1 million people who have fled externally into refugee camps in the sub-region. We have another more 1 million people internally displaced. So Liberians didn't know what role this guy was playing. But as the West African Peacekeeping Force came to Liberia, as the United Nations came and they brokered the peace, and people began to hear this guy's name. And I also serve on the Truth Commission. Besides being a journalist, I serve on the Truth Commission, and we investigated what happened in Liberia, and his name came up. As a matter of fact, Mr. Victor Bout is listed in the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for further investigation in his role that he's played. He's named in our report.
That's Liberian journalist Masa Washington. Masa, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The prisoner exchange of Victor Bout for Brittany Griner is an encouraging sign for families of other Americans imprisoned in Russia. Mark Fogel has been detained since August of last year. His family is hoping Griner's release means that he's one step closer to returning home. Julia Zenkovich from member station WESA reports.
For much of his career, Fogel taught the children of ambassadors and diplomats at international schools across the globe. In August 2021, he was headed to Russia to start his 10th and final year of teaching at the Anglo-American School of Moscow, but he never made it to the school. Instead, he was arrested in a Moscow airport for carrying a small amount of prescribed medical marijuana he used to treat debilitating chronic back pain. His case bears a striking similarity with Griner's. Fogel was charged with drug smuggling and possession and was given a 14-year sentence. This fall, the 61-year-old was moved to IK2, a hard labor penal colony. Lisa Highland, Fogel's sister, says she's happy Griner is home. She's trying to be optimistic about what that could mean for her brother's safe return.
Certainly, I'm very glad that she's come home. She didn't deserve the sentence that she got either. It's somewhat hopeful in that, obviously there are still negotiations going on. But of course, we want Mark to be the one on that plane.
Highland and her family are working with members of Congress to have Fogel declared wrongfully detained. The designation would allow the U.S. government to put more resources towards securing his release. But Highland is disappointed that her brother's case seems to have drawn less attention than those of other detained Americans. When President Joe Biden announced Griner's release, he mentioned Paul Whelan, a former U.S. Marine detained on espionage charges, but not Fogel.
One thing that's been discouraging is we haven't heard Mark's name, at the press conferences. And I'd like to hear President Biden mention Mark's name, too.
Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, Democratic Congressman Connor Lamb, and Republican Congressman Guy Reschenthaler have all urged the Biden administration to prioritize Fogel's return. On Thursday, a spokesperson for the State Department reaffirmed the department's commitment to helping people detained overseas, but declined to comment on Fogel's case specifically. Highland said she is not aware of any prisoner swap plan for Fogel. For NPR News, I'm Julia Zenkovich in Pittsburgh.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WNYC at 8:29. Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, how Mayor Adams hopes to meet his ambitious new housing goal and how it will affect the ongoing housing crisis, both right now and down the road. Plus, your reasons to love New York. That's this morning at 10 on 93.9 FM, AM 820, or you can listen online at WNYC.org.
WNYC supporters include Apple Original Films and A24, presenting Causeway, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Brian Tyree Henry, rated R. More information at fyc.appletvplus.com. Leadership funding for WNYC is provided by the Jerome L. Green Foundation, a proud supporter of New York City's major cultural institutions.
If you believe democracy requires a free press, your station is WNYC. 93.9 FM and AM 820. NPR News and the New York Conversation.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A former Libyan intelligence officer suspected of making the bomb that brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, is expected to appear in court in Washington. He was taken into U.S. custody nearly 34 years after the bombing. It killed 270 people, mostly Americans. 11 of those who died were on the ground in Lockerbie. Foreign ministers with the European Union are considering additional sanctions on Iran following Tehran's second execution of an anti-government protester. As Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, these latest penalties are expected to address Iran's public executions as well as its sale of drones to Russia.
The EU wants to put more pressure on the Iranian government over its heavy-handed treatment of demonstrators and to offer a strong response to Iran assisting Russia in its war against Ukraine.
Das sind insbesondere die Revolutionsgarden.
German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock says more members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard will be targeted over the drone sales after its chief was blacklisted last month. Individuals who try to intimidate and punish demonstrators with what Baerbock calls violently coerced videos will also be targeted. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell says he spoke with the Iranian foreign minister, who continues to deny his government has supplied drones to Moscow. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WNYC at 8:31. Good morning. I'm Carrie Nolan. We're in the thick of the morning rush, and unsurprisingly, there are slowdowns on most routes into Manhattan. Among the heaviest, the Queensboro and George Washington bridges. And on the subway, we've got delays on Middle Village-bound M trains and service disruptions on southbound No. 1 trains. Brooklyn Republican Lester Chang is pushing back against doubts he officially lives in the district he was elected to represent. At a press conference in Brooklyn's Chinatown, attended by News 12, Chang told supporters his family has been in the neighborhood for a half century.
I am personally offended that anyone would challenge my honor and integrity.
Chang was voted as assemblymember for the Brooklyn neighborhoods of Bensonhurst and Diker Heights. It was an upset win over longtime Democratic incumbent Peter Abadi. Abadi says Chang was registered to vote in Manhattan less than a year prior to the win. While investigations into residency status are rare, Democratic lawmakers in Albany are holding a hearing on Chang's residency later this month. It could block him from taking the seat. The new school's teachers' strike is ending after 25 days. The part-time teachers' union and the university reached a tentative agreement on Saturday. The union's bargaining committee said they got everything they asked for in the deal, and the committee asked members to ratify the contract when it's available for a vote later this week. Marie-Hélène Bertino is a professor of creative writing at the new school. She's elated with the outcome.
It will be life-changing for me and my family. Life-changing.
The new contract includes higher pay, easier access to health care, payment for time worked away from the classroom, and more. Bertino, like all teachers, are going back to work just in time for the last week of classes before winter break. A heads up to J-Train riders, you might be in for a lot of service suspensions over the next 2 years as the city repairs the Williamsburg Bridge. The Department of Transportation is proposing to suspend service over 25 weekends in 2023 and 2024. This will allow the DOT to replace corroded steel that supports the train tracks, as well as drainage pipes, valves, and joints. For its part, the MTA says it has not yet finalized a schedule. Well, the clouds are beginning to break up, and we'll see a mostly sunny day today with highs in the upper 30s. Clear tonight with lows in the mid-20s, and sunny again tomorrow with highs in the lower 40s. It's 32 degrees and cloudy in New York City.
Support for NPR comes from WNYC members and from DataIQ, a platform for everyday AI, to help organizations make AI part of their daily business, designed to elevate people, teams, and companies. DataIQ.com. And Little Passports, designed to help children discover the world with hands-on activity kits delivered monthly for ages 3 and up. Learn more at littlepassports.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Fed and the European Central Bank are considering raising interest rates again as soon as this week in their battle against inflation. Here to talk about what this means to American consumers, we turn to David Wessel. He's the director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. David, so let's start off with inflation here. How likely is it that a slow and steady approach wins this race?
Well, look, progress against inflation is very slow. We'd get some more data tomorrow, the Consumer Price Index for November, and it'll probably show that some of the supply chain pressures that have been driving up prices are beginning to abate. I mean, like prices of apparel and used cars have been coming down. Gasoline prices have fallen as well. Now, the CPI and report for October was encouraging, but then last week we got discouraging news on wholesale prices. Overall, the problem is that prices are still climbing much faster than the Fed's 2% goal. Even if you exclude volatile food and energy prices, which is a way to gauge the underlying pace of inflation, consumer prices rose more than 6% over the past year. In short, inflation just isn't coming down fast enough to get the Fed to relax.
All right, so then what is the Fed going to try and do about this?
Well, it's going to keep raising interest rates. Interest rates started the year at zero, which is extraordinary. The Fed has raised them unusually fast by 3.75 percentage points so far, and it signaled that it's going to raise them another half percentage point when their meeting concludes on Wednesday. From Jay Powell on down, Fed officials have said, we're going to keep raising rates until we're sure we've beaten inflation back into the ground. How much more are they going to go up? Well, that really depends on the economy. But there's now a good chance that the Fed will push short-term interest rates above 5% next year and hold them there for a while until it's convinced that inflation is gone.
All right, above 5%. So how are these interest rates hikes then affecting the U.S. economy?
Look, the Fed is trying to slow the increase in demand, the amount we buy, the amount businesses spend, so that they match the available supply in the economy and relieve the upward pressure on prices. That's the strategy. So far, the pace of economic growth is slowing. The most immediate impact has been on the housing market. Rates on 30-year mortgages have risen from 3% at the beginning of the year to well above 6%. But the job market has been surprisingly strong. Even though the number of vacant jobs has fallen, unemployment remains low. And Fed Chair Jay Powell keeps saying that wages are rising faster than consistent with his 2% inflation goal. So they're going to keep raising interest rates. And the more they raise rates, the greater the chances of a recession next year, which some, but not all, forecasters are now anticipating.
Yeah, and rising inflation is not just a United States problem. It's a global one, too. So how do things here in the U.S., David, compare to the rest of the world?
So inflation is rising everywhere around the world, or it's above target. And that tells you that there's some common forces at work here. The disruption of supply chains due to COVID-19, which, among other things, keeps shutting Chinese factories. And, of course, the surge in food and energy prices that have been triggered by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I mean, inflation is high everywhere, even in Japan, which has been wrestling with deflation for years. But in Europe, inflation is much worse than the United States. Prices there are up more than 10% in the past year alone, and that's largely driven by natural gas prices. And so while the Fed is raising rates to slow an economy that it thinks is growing too fast, the European Central Bank has a much harder job. It's dealing with above-target inflation, raising interest rates to fight inflation, an economy that is growing very slowly, and where the unemployment rate is double the rate in the United States.
That's David Wessel of the Brookings Institution. David, thanks.
You're welcome.
Mexicans celebrate the Virgin of Guadalupe today. More than 3 million Mexicans made a pilgrimage to the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe to pay their homage. It was the first pilgrimage to be held without any restrictions after the pandemic. NPR's Eder Peralta sent us this postcard.
The pilgrims make their way to the basilica for miles on a promenade. It's an awe-inspiring display of humanity. Some pilgrims carry statues of the Virgin tied to their backs. Others, in groups, carry entire altars while they sing. Jasmine and Adolfo Gutierrez say they got up at 4 a.m. to begin their walk.
Por fe. Mucha fe.
It's because of our faith, he says.
Y agradecimiento. Sobre todo agradecimiento.
And gratitude. Gratitude above all else, says his wife. They're alive, she says, despite all the bad. A war, a pandemic, a bad economy, but they're alive. This pilgrimage is one of the largest in the world. It dates back almost 500 years when Catholics believed the Virgin Mary appeared before San Juan Diego, an indigenous farmer. She left on his cloak an image of a brown-skinned Virgin of Guadalupe. Until this day, that cloak hangs inside the basilica, and worshippers trek for days, for weeks, sometimes from thousands of miles away, to get a glimpse of this relic and the hill where this apparition happened. Some of them get on their knees and crawl for miles. When I kneel to talk to Michelle Perez Cornejo, she grimaces with pain. I ask her why she does this.
Por un tío que falleció y otra por mis hijos, por mi abuelita que falleció hace 2 años.
Her kids got sick, and she promised the Virgin if they got better, she would make this sacrifice. Her grandmother also died 2 years ago, and this year her uncle died. Here, on her knees, she could already see the hill that's brought her so much solace. I ask what she's feeling.
Pues a la vez emoción y a la vez tristeza por mi tío porque no está allá conmigo, pero cada que él venía, él subía conmigo el cerrito.
Happiness and sadness, she says. Her uncle was a believer. For 4 years, they climbed to the top of Tepeyac Hill. In his honor, she will climb that hill on her knees. The crowd moves from the promenade to the church. There's music and tears and joy and laughter and undying devotion. Gracia Martinez, who is 55, has made this trip for 25 years.
Tenemos lo material, ¿no? Pero a veces hace falta algo del corazón.
We have the material things, she says, but sometimes what's missing is in the heart. That's when she prays to the Virgin, she says, when she doesn't understand her kids, when someone gets sick, or when life just seems too hard. It's the Virgin, she says, who gives her strength. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Desde el cielo una hermosa mañana. Desde el cielo una hermosa mañana. La Guadalupana, la Guadalupana.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future, and the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition on WNYC. I'm Carrie Nolan. Next year, the MTA's newest subway cars will start hitting the tracks. They'll feature the latest bells and whistles and replace some of the oldest train cars running on the lettered lines. As WNYC's Stephen Nesson reports, they're also replacing a style of seating as old as the subway system itself.
On a Q train crossing the Manhattan Bridge, 30-year-old Annalise Yu from Los Angeles is pressing her face up against the glass. She stares toward Lower Manhattan, eyes tracing the horizon. She's sitting snugly next to her sister in an orange bucket seat, an arrangement known as conversational seating.
I think they're great. If you're able to sit like this so you could look out the window, that's great.
It was the configuration on the very first subway car 118 years ago, back when seats were cloth, not plastic. The vintage seats with a 1970s color palette
are arranged in an L shape, unlike the modern train cars with single benches facing each other.
It's funny it's called conversational because I feel like I could be more like private in this setting.
That's Marie Green from Kensington. Her mother is sitting across from her, knees nearly touching. Her boyfriend, Sean Noonan, says he appreciates the nostalgia of the old trains, but he also likes getting to work on time.
You know, I'm always happier to see, you know, new trains come into because that means, you know, we're getting a more efficient, you know, transit system, which is ultimately what New York needs.
He's right. The older trains break down about twice as frequently as new ones. And trains with conversational seating are typically more than 50 years old. This spring, the first batch of the MTA's newest subway cars will be put into service. The agency is ordering more than 1,000 of these, which will replace the older trains over the next 5 years. New York City Transit President Richard Davey says he respects the old style, but new trains come with essential features, like built-in digital signal equipment and security cameras.
You know, all good things probably must come to an end, and this is no different.
Davey says more people can fit on the new trains as well.
The bench seating coupled with wider aisles, you know, make it so that more customers can be on a train comfortably, but then also the flow of getting on and off, you know, reducing our dwell time in stations, which during the height of rush hour or service can be detrimental then to service quality.
Still, some riders, like 33-year-old Veronica Karpowicz, have mixed feelings.
I don't like the benches because there's not kind of that marker of where you should contain yourself, which I feel like for a lot of people is really necessary. But this sideways configuration, you get a lot of people that take up both seats anyways, or they put their feet up on the other side, and that bothers me almost more than people kind of spreading more than they should.
As her train crests over the Manhattan Bridge, she changes her tune.
I mean, the majority of the time, you don't really care, right? But right now we're going over the bridge and it is a lot nicer.
Stephen Nesson, WNYC News.